we're going to turn things over to our facilitated panel discussion, and Dana Spindler from ICS is going to facilitate that for us, and then afterwards we should have a few minutes to take some questions from the audience. Dana?
Thanks, Emma, and thanks to all the speakers for your presentations, and we just have a few minutes left, so we'll do sort of a rapid round of the panel discussion. And our first question is for Chris and Alex and Scott. During the introduction and during the Philadelphia presentation, we heard about how mitigation and adaptation differ in some aspects and overlap in others. How can the overlaps be leveraged to reduce concerns about uncertainty? And can you give us a specific example of where synergies between mitigation and adaptation were effectively leveraged? Chris, why don't I pass it over to you?
Yes, thanks, Dana. Well, I think Debbie actually concluded with a great example with the sort of coordination of green space development with the transit in Miami-Dade County. You know, one of the major drivers of greenhouse gas emissions are urban areas, and in particular the transportation footprint of any particular urban area is going to have a huge influence on the amount of greenhouse gases that that it contributes. And so simultaneously, you know, how you kind of lay out your urban form in terms of urban planning and so on is going to have a huge impact on vulnerability to you know, different kinds of potential climate change impacts, whether it's, you know, flooding due to sea level rise or, you know, how vulnerable your power grid might be to outages or storms or, you know, public health implications of heat waves and existence of cool and green space and so on. So there's a really, really strong synergy between adaptation and mitigation that's kind of inherent in urban planning and doing things, you know, getting these double wins like, you know, laying out your transportation networks, let's say, to both reduce, you know, encourage transit ridership to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but then also to co-develop green space that have, you know, climate adaptation potential as well. So, you know, I think we can start to see a lot of those synergies in some of these forward-looking cities where they're you know, really, really focusing on urban planning, and that's a way to kind of get wins on both the adaptation and mitigation side.
Yeah, and this is Alex in Philadelphia. I would just kind of echo some of what Chris said. In addition to the cool roof example and green infrastructure examples that we shared, I think from the urban planning perspective, we also talked a little bit about the changes to our zoning code and to our comprehensive plan that can have those kinds of impacts that Chris is mentioning. And just one quick example of that is some changes that we made in zoning give density bonuses to projects that achieve things like LEED for neighborhood development. So you can get a density bonus if you're achieving at a high level there. And the reason that works on both the mitigation and adaptation fronts is that it's favoring compact, transit-oriented development that reduces vehicle miles traveled. It integrates, by default, green infrastructure requirements and building materials and practices that reduce energy load and mitigate things like the heat island impacts that we see here in Philadelphia.
Thank you both for your responses. The next question will be for Debbie and Anne. And during the final presentation, Debbie provided us with a great example of how counties in Southeast Florida are making a regional effort to lay the groundwork for local action. In many cases, larger cities may have more resources that can be used to understand the local impacts and best practices for adapting to climate change. How can a small town or a city leverage work that has been completed in neighboring municipalities or work in collaboration with neighbors in the region to develop strategies that are applicable locally? Debbie, I'll hand it over to you.
Sorry, I had trouble with my mute button. I would say that in terms of
climate science and gaining traction on projections and things, reaching out to universities that are doing relevant work would be really important. And NOAA's Regional Integrated Science and Assessment Programs, RESAs, also often support that kind of work for larger areas than the municipality, you know, itself. Also, there are usually technical networks or regional sector groups. Let's say if you have an MPO that is probably larger than an individual municipality, or if you have a water management association, you know, I would encourage folks to work within those organizations with their counterparts from other cities and counties and those organizations to start to talk about integrating climate change into the planning and work that they govern through those organizations.
And this is Ann. I guess just to follow on what Debbie said, I agree with everything that you said. I think another way to get started is to think about what plans are in the works right now. So if you want to just get started and you have very limited resources, potentially thinking about whether there are updates to your national, you know, your hazard mitigation planning process or your long-range transportation planning processes. I think just adding a climate layer on top of some of those types of planning processes might allow you to see who in the region or who in your locality is interested in this topic and who recognizes that some of the decisions that they're making or the investments that they're making are potentially climate or weather sensitive, and then potentially matching those people up with the academic resources or some of the climate sort of modeling folks locally, including the RESAs, that might be enough to sort of start the ball rolling and give you the momentum that you need to sort of have, you know, to break off into working groups and potentially develop a more comprehensive strategy.
Thanks, Ann and Debbie. And so we're going to move into our Q&A session. We have about 5 minutes left, so I'll try and get at least one question to each of the speakers. This question's for Alex and Scott. And relative to conventional pavement, how does porous pavement hold up under extreme heat?
The pavement that we've used on Percy Street, where I showed the example, it so far has held up very well and is actually engineered to work to carry the same engineering load as some of our largest thoroughfares in Philadelphia. So we don't have any concerns about heat or extreme cold, and actually the paving mix performs better in terms of managing winter weather than traditional pavement does, because a lot of the precipitation that falls that's close to the freezing threshold is going to be absorbed by that rather than sitting on the surface and creating ice.
Great. Thank you. Chris, this question is for you. Could you talk a little bit more about the challenge and appropriate uses of downscale data? Is it useful to downscale to a sub-regional or local level?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, it can be useful, but the first, you know, there's sort of two things to remember, I guess. The first thing is that, you know, the usefulness of doing downscaling to get higher resolution climate information is really going to be dictated by the needs of your particular adaptation decision and your agency's mission and so on. So it's certainly not going to be the case that downscaling is always going to be necessary or add value. And the one thing that that you also have to be aware of is that higher resolution information does not mean that information is more accurate. The sort of accuracy of what sort of climate changes you might be seeing in your region is, the first order really dictated by what the global scale models are saying. And a lot of the downscaling, whether it's sort of statistical regression type analysis where you're linking future trends to historical trends, or whether you're actually running a higher resolution model for your region of interest, really what they're going to do is they're going to put in, they're going to add value associated with things like local topography, the details of your coastline, the influence of different land use and land cover types in your small region of interest, the sort of microclimate that you that distinguishes, you know, your region or distinguishes a city, let's say, from the surrounding countryside. But they're not going to, it's not going to add any additional information about what sort of future climate is more likely for your region. It's just going to take a future climate proposed by a global model and add some of these local contextual factors to it, which may be very useful in making it more relevant to plug that data into, you know, your particular impacts models or management models or understanding it in your local context. But it's not going to add any additional accuracy.
Thanks. And this next question is for you. If you start with sensitivity analysis, how do you define the scope of your area that you are concerned with for a particular type of impact? For example, don't you need to have some understanding of what areas will be at risk of flooding that were not previously at risk, such as future storm surges that affect an area that does not have a historic experience with storm surge?
No, that's a great question, and honestly, and I'm glad you brought it up. So, in the case that in the example that I shared, actually, we weren't worried about storm surge in that particular line, but in other cases, we may look at a sensitivity analysis is not a substitute for a sort of a high level evaluation of A, you know, what decisions are we trying to influence, and what climate variables have the most potential to impact to affect those kinds of decisions or those assets or services we're concerned about. So in this case, obviously there may be places that are susceptible to storm surge that have never seen storm surge before. And in those cases, what you may be able to do is look at, for example, there's some places where we're actually looking at what inundation under a king tide scenario looks like as some indication of where there are sensitivities associated with water sort of at higher water levels than are typical for a particular location, but that even that doesn't get there. So when you're thinking about storm surge analysis, it may be that you need to look at a couple of different scenarios and run some models. There are many, many models that are available to do this. Some, like one we've applied in the Gulf Coast region for Mobile, Alabama, it's very, very detailed modeling, very expensive modeling, but it was warranted insofar as this is a place, Mobile, Alabama, that's experienced significant tropical storms in the past and where, you know, we had the opportunity based on the available data to be able to run, you know, ADCIRC plus ST Wave, you know, these sort of high-end models to come up with a very rich set of information on not only storm surge but also sea level rise. So in that case, we actually had to go that far because we were looking at a coastal area and because we knew that the past is not like the future. So it's not to say the sensitivity analysis can be a substitute for, you know, climate modeling or storm surge modeling in this case, but there are some instances where spending the money on that kind of analysis would not be the best use of resources right out of the gate. I don't know if Chris, you may want to comment on that as well.
No, I agree with that. That's right on.
Thanks, Ann. So I want to round it out with one more question for Debbie. And the question is, what is the biggest lesson learned in moving towards implementation? Is there a key approach that works particularly well that could help other communities move forward with adaptation?
I think it's that we definitely, during the planning process, we cast a very wide net. We tried our best to make sure that all the stakeholders were at least invited to the table and encouraged them to stay at the table. So that, I think, is critical to moving forward with the implementation because, for example, let's take the transportation area. We had folks there in our working groups who told us, what they were doing, you know, when their planning time frames were, what their, you know, when the next opportunity to integrate things were coming up. We learned from them, you know, their craft and their expertise were brought in during the planning process, so they helped us to craft what the implementation steps should be. So I really think that that hopefully is going to help us to improve our implementation.
Thank you. So I want to hand it back over to Emma to wrap up the webcast. Thank you all.
Thank you, Dana, and thank you again to all of our presenters for sharing your expertise and experience, and thank you to everyone on the line who hung on for a few extra minutes so we could get to those questions. Any questions that we were not able to answer at the end of the call today, we will be providing written responses that we'll post on our website along with the other materials. So with that, I would just like to say thank you again to everyone, and please register and join us for the May 1st call where we'll be talking about opportunities to work with the public health sector and hazard mitigation departments to leverage resources and funding opportunities for adaptation work. So with that, thank you again, and hopefully you will join us again soon.
Thank you.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.